It's Philosophy Talk.
I haven't spent most of my life behind bars for nothing. I've reached a few conclusions about penology, and a couple of them may be valid.
What's it like to teach philosophy in prison?
What's it like to learn philosophy while in prison?
You want your prisoners to dance out the gates like puppets on a string, with rubber stamp values, impressed by you, with your sense of conformity, your sense of behavior, even your sense of morality.
Well, don't you know?
That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Yeah.
Is a philosophically educated prisoner more compliant or more unruly?
Our guest is Jennifer Lackey, who teaches philosophy at Northwestern University and at Stateville Correctional Center.
Philosophy behind bars.
Well, don't you know?
That's the sound of the men working on the chain.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken and I teach philosophy.
And today we're thinking about philosophy behind bars.
What's it like to teach philosophy in a prison? What's it like to study it there?
Well, prison, John, I would guess, is probably not the most conducive setting for philosophy in any mode.
Well, certainly not here in the good old U.S. of A. Our prisons are overcrowded warehouses. They're excessively focused on punishment. You know, it's not that way everywhere. You should see the prisons in Norway.
Well, I don't really want to see the inside of a prison anywhere, John.
Well, the point is that prisons don't have to be so bleak. They can be places of rehabilitation, education, and repair.
You know, I'm all for rehabilitation, but we are talking America here, and the reality of America is that we're obsessed with punishment.
Yeah, but that's kind of a false dichotomy. It doesn't have to be rehabilitation versus punishment. I hate to keep harping on Norway.
But I'm sure you will.
Yeah, well, they're great people. The Norwegians think that losing freedom and being confined are already punishment enough. They feel no need to heap on additional daily insults to inmates' dignity. That attitude frees them to focus much more on rehabilitation and education.
Well, okay, that's fine for Norway, but Norway is Norway. This is America.
Well, we could learn a lot from the Norwegians.
Well, I'm sure we could, but I bet we won't.
Well, a lot of people are trying to improve things here. Some of them are working on large-scale prison reform at the state and national levels.
Well, good luck with that in the current political environment.
But of interest to us today are some of them are working down in the trenches, trying to reach one inmate at a time. A surprising number of those folks are philosophers.
But okay. I'm going to play along, but I've got to ask you, why philosophy? If you're going to teach inmates anything, shouldn't it be something more practical and job-oriented? I mean, besides, a philosophically educated inmate, I'm sure some people believe, is probably a more unruly, questioning, and skeptical inmate.
Well, or maybe a more sober and reflective one, more prepared to take stock of his life. And what's more practical than people that have started off on the wrong path getting back on the right path?
Well, if it were a perfect world, but you know, John, it's not a perfect world. Education dollars are scarce in this country. I mean, who can blame people for wanting to spend more money on our underfunded high schools and universities and less on prison education? After all, that will actually help keep more people out of prison in the first place.
Another false dichotomy, Ken. We can educate both the free and the incarcerated.
Well, tell that to financially strapped inner city school districts. John, tell that to parents struggling with the cost of college tuition.
I would rather tell it to politicians wasting money in all sorts of ways. We're a rich country. I mean, we've got the wallet. What we lack is the will.
Well, I don't know.
Besides, our current prison system is much more expensive than it needs to be, partly because the door to the prison cell, it's a revolving door.
You're talking about recidivism rates, I take it.
Yeah, in the USA, they're the highest in the world, Ken. If we focus more resources on education and rehabilitation, recidivism would be a lot lower, and the prison system would be a lot less costly, and there would be a lot more education dollars to go around everywhere.
Well, Jen, look, you have convinced me of something I think important.
What, that I'm just a softy liberal do-gooder? I thought you knew that already.
Yeah, I did know that. You've convinced me that the real problem isn't financial. That's just a distraction. The real problem is our inability to appreciate the humanity of the incarcerated. When you warehouse prisoners away and run a revolving door system like we do, it's far too easy to just forget about the incarcerated at best or completely demonize them at worst.
And the reason for that is a disproportionate number of brown and black people in our prisons. That's a problem Norway doesn't have, a much more homogeneous country.
Yeah, our whole approach is, frankly, I think, a recipe for disaster.
Ah, now you're getting the message, Ken.
So how do we shine a light on the humanity of the incarcerated? How do we do that?
Well, here's step one. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to learn how a philosophy in prison program works. It's one in Kansas, and it led one trans woman inmate to explore gender and self-identity, and that empowered her both inside and outside the prison walls. Shuka files this report.
When Joanne Ramsey was 18 years old, she fell in love with a 16-year-old boy, a minor. She was sentenced to 8 years in prison. During that time, she was physically and emotionally abused by her fellow inmates. Joanne is transgender, but at the time, she had not transitioned.
I was raped my first day. And so that was like a wake-up call to like figure out how I was going to handle, you know, the next 100 months of my life in this environment.
Growing up, Joanne was quiet and shy, but that doesn't work in a maximum security prison. She quickly learned to put on a mask.
You know, like the drag queen persona. That's really popular in prison because it keeps you safe. The louder you are, the more visible you are, the harder it is for someone to pull you off by yourself. The harder it is for someone to isolate you and, you know, have the opportunity for abuse.
After 6 years of battling, Joanne became the first transgender woman in the state of Kansas to transition while incarcerated. But the first time she really thought about gender was when she read Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex during a philosophy course in prison. The book explores the historical treatment of women.
I think for a while I got stuck in these like campy heteronormative gender roles. And so like to read this feminist philosophy and to kind of, you know, challenge myself and what I viewed as femininity was really empowering to me.
Joanne was able to talk to her classmates, her fellow inmates, about her experience as a transgender woman. Joanne loved her philosophy class. She'd even make sure all her classmates did their readings and arrived to class on time. She wanted her colleagues to know that, despite what they've been told, despite being in prison, they had the capacity for critical thinking. Sydney Harvey is with the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She's the founder of the Philosophy in Prison program at Lansing Correctional Facility in Kansas. Joanne was one of Sydney's favorite students.
She was fantastic at bringing whatever discussion we were talking about, whether it was Nietzsche or the Upanishads, and she had a way to bring it back to her particular situation. And I really respected that because it had these men who I kind of got the feeling normally didn't care to speak about her particular situation. They were very comfortable in the room, and she had an outlet for that.
Sydney's prison philosophy class consists of about 15 inmates and 6 philosophy students from the university. The students and inmates read and discuss ancient Eastern philosophy, Western philosophy, and Thomas Nagel's What It's Like to Be a Bat, a favorite of the inmates.
I find it very gratifying to know that we can take a philosophy text like Descartes and bring it into a prison and, first of all, prove that prisoners can comprehend this level of text, and second, to prove that philosophy is not just for a niche group of elite scholars who are trained on how to read it. Philosophy is about life, and it's about humanity, and it's about existence, and I firmly believe that anyone who belongs into one of those categories can understand philosophy if they want to.
Joanne, the transgender woman who encouraged all her peers to take Sydney's philosophy course, never got to finish the course herself. She was released from prison partway through the semester, in September 2016.
You know, being in the philosophy class, it kind of gave me a little bit more confidence to go back to school, and so I've enrolled in Johnson County Community College. I don't know if I necessarily would have had the same amount of confidence if I hadn't taken some of these college-type courses that are offered in the prison system. And the philosophy class is probably one of the most difficult ones, and so you have to really dedicate yourself to that and explore some different ideas.
Today, Joanne lives in transitional housing in Kansas City. After only 5 months out of prison, she got promoted to manager at her job at Dunkin' Donuts. But Joanne says that's just the beginning. Access to higher education in prison, especially philosophy education, showed Joanne that even after 8 years behind bars, she has the power to succeed. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
I'm John Perry. Thanks, Shuka, for that interesting report. I'm here with my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor, in San Francisco.
And today we're asking about philosophy behind bars. We're joined now by Jennifer Lackey. She's a professor of philosophy at Northwestern University, and she also teaches philosophy at Stateville Correctional Center near Chicago. Jennifer, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks, John. It's wonderful to be here.
So, Jennifer, tell me, you know, some time ago when you were an enterprising young philosopher, probably with tenure and promotion in the future and fame, but back then you decided to teach inmates in prison. I mean, how did that come about?
Well, I've had a longstanding interest in the prison population. It began even while I was a child. When I was 12, I was needed to do a service project for my school, and while my friends were babysitting and visiting retirement homes, I decided that I wanted to work with the incarcerated population. So I pulled out my Care Bear stationery, and I wrote to Cook County Jail. I had grown up in Chicago, and they ended up sending a car for me and brought me to the jail, and I worked with the women. I ended up baking, you know, 12 dozen cookies for them and went into their cells and met with them and spoke with them. And for many of the women, this was a very, powerful experience because many of them had left their own children back home. And I think one of the things that motivated me back then is the same thing that's motivating me today, knowing that at some level, we all bear responsibility for incarceration. And while when I was 12, I didn't have the concept of mass incarceration and I hadn't read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, I think I knew even back then that we all bear some responsibility for, the members of our society.
Well, now, Jennifer, I'm sure in Illinois, you've got lots of prisons that are kind of white-collar prisons devoted to ex-mayors and ex-governors. But you're not teaching in one of those. You're teaching in a prison for hardcore inmates. Could you tell us what it's like? What it's like for you as a teacher first, and then maybe a little bit about what it's like for the students themselves?
Right. So I teach at Stateville Correctional Center. That's a maximum security men's prison. Nearly all of my students have been convicted of at least one murder. And most of the prisoners at Stateville have at least 25 years left on their sentence. So it comes with all of the challenges that working in a maximum security prison environment bring along. There are constant challenges with security and with bringing course materials and with even getting the students into the classroom.
Are you ever afraid for yourself?
No, I have never been afraid for myself. I mean, my students, I mean, there are the issues arise. I mean, there are, things come up. There might be some tense situation with a correctional officer or, a couple of weeks ago, I wasn't leaving the classroom quickly enough. And so one of the correctional officers turned the lights off. And my students were actually really upset about this for my safety. They said, why would they put you in a dark room with us?
Yeah.
And I said, I didn't feel worried about myself at all. But they were worried for me, right? They said, you should not be in a dark room
I mean, how do your students regard this? I mean, you could imagine a cynical person thinking, oh, the students are just looking for kind of an hour a week or whatever, however, away from the grind. But do they regard this as just an escape? Are they really invested in it? I mean, what's it like for them?
You know, Ken, that's an excellent question, but I'll tell you, I have rarely in my 16 years of teaching come across more engaged, more passionate, more committed students than my students at Stateville. I'm teaching an ethics course right now, and we still have, I mean, at least a month and a half left of the term, but they have a course packet. One of my students came in and said, I've done all of the reading already for the rest of the term. You look in his course packet, it's highlighted. He reads the articles two or three times. This is not uncommon. I mean, I had a student last semester who had been out playing basketball on the yard and thought that he broke his ankle, and he had two of his classmates help him hobble to my classroom rather than go get an x-ray because he said I was not going to miss a class period.
Wow, Jennifer, this is really amazing. I really want to dig into this with you after we take a short break here. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about philosophy behind bars.
In our next segment, we'll ask a key question. Is spending educational time and effort on people who've started down the wrong path really a wise investment, or should we devote our resources and dollars on those that are not yet on the wrong path?
Prison education, its social cost and benefits, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Serving a long prison sentence might give someone plenty of time to further their education. Where would philosophy fit into all that? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about philosophy behind bars.
Our guest is Jennifer Lackey. She teaches philosophy at Northwestern University and also at Stateville Correctional Center near Chicago.
So, Jennifer, you teach in two worlds. At Northwestern, you teach some of the most privileged, well-prepared students in the world. At Stateville, I would guess your students are neither privileged nor prepared in the same way. And I'd like you to start by comparing and contrasting for us these two different sets of students and how you approach the challenge of teaching each of them. I mean, so tell us more about the actual teaching.
Sure. So certainly, you know, there are differences in the level of preparedness, I mean, between the students. I mean, I have students who came in, you know, prison, and they were unable to read or write. And now they're sitting in a classroom where I should be clear, I teach my classes at Stateville with the same content and expectations that I teach where I teach my Northwestern classes. So I don't have different, you know, requirements, the same. They're very writing intensive. They're very reading intensive. And I grade them with the same grading rubric that I use at Northwestern, and I have the same expectations.
Is that an insult to the Northwestern students or a compliment to the prison students at Stateville?
Well, I take it that it would be a compliment to the students at Stateville because, I mean, you know, the work is of very high quality. I have to tell you, I was extremely surprised by the caliber of many of the students at Stateville. I mean, obviously some of them struggle, but, you know, I think in most of our classrooms we have students who struggle. And the struggles are different. Of course, you know, you have to keep in mind many of the students at Stateville have issues going on in their lives. You know, I mean, they end up with a new cellmate and they've got problems getting the work done and that sort of thing. So there are those kinds of issues. You know, the prison might be on lockdown for a month, and so they miss my class for 4 weeks. You know, so there are all sorts of practical interruptions to their education that my Northwestern students don't face.
Tell me, what do you think they're – I mean, okay, so you told us in our first segment that your students at Stateville feel very passionately about this. I mean, they really care about this, and you just told us you hold them to the same standards as you hold your Northwestern students, which I would know to be – because I know you and I know the kind of a very high standard indeed, right? Tell me what do you think these men at Stateville are looking to get out of this? Why do they care so much about this?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, I think first of all, you have to keep in mind, every single one of my students in my class were convicted of their crimes between the ages of 14 and 25. Most of them are in their 30s and 40s and 50s. So they've grown up in prison. And they had to make a choice at some point. Who do I want to be? You know, do I want to be one of the guys who sits and, you know, plays, you know, gambles all day in their cells? Or do I want to be, you know, a better person? And I think for many of them, they're doing it for their children. I hear lots of them say, I want my children to go to college. I want my children to value education. And I want them to see that that their fathers are capable of doing this. For some of them, they're doing it for themselves. For some of them, they're doing it because they, I mean, I had two students last semester who were on death row for a long time before the death penalty was abolished in Illinois. And so for them, they feel like they have a second chance at life.
So
you know?
These students, especially like the ones on death row, I've read a lot about this in preparation for this show, and I've talked to you in the past, and I've read some of the stuff you've written, and it seems to me there's really something profound going on. Look, every human being, every single human being, faces this question: who am I to be? What am I to do with my life? When these guys were young, a lot of them made some really bad choices and really bad decisions. But that doesn't end the quest for who am I to be? What am I to be? It sounds like some of your students, especially if you think about the ones in death row who have no chance, they're not even thinking about life outside of prison. They're engaged in something really profound that is characteristic of the profoundest human kind of things that we do, deciding who am I to be? What am I to care about? What am I to devote my life to?
Absolutely. I mean, two of my students last semester who were on death row, one had been on death row for decades. I mean, in fact, he had been neighbors with John Wayne Gacy, you know, in the next cell. And when my other student arrived on death row, Samuel, you know, he said that, you know, just hearing, you know, the state say to you, you know, your life is worth nothing. It is, you know, we no longer want you to even be alive. He walked into his cell and he said it was like a curtain came down on him. Everything was over. His life was over. And my other student, William, passed by his cell, reached through the bars and handed him a book. And he said, it changed my life. It saved my life. He said, I sat down and I started to try to read this book. William helped me read it. You know, next door, they would like talk to each other, you know, out loud. And he said, I started to realize that I could be something, you know, I could be someone, something that no one had ever told me in my life. No teacher, no community member, no parent, no sibling. You know, I could do this. So, and he says it quite literally saved his life.
So, Jennifer, it's inspiring, but it raises the question. You have a finite amount of resources in your life. The America has a finite amount of resources. What do you say to someone? Say, well, let's spend those resources on the inner city kids, or the drug crazed suburban kids, or the other kids who might find these same things that the prisoners find, but find it early enough in their lives before they kill someone and end up in prison. So what do you say to that?
All right, so I have lots of things to say to that, so you'll have to cut me off at some point. But I mean, first of all, you have to keep in mind that these students are still members indirectly of their, you know, their communities back home. They have children, they have friends, they have brothers, sisters, relatives, mothers, you know. And so, you know, they are still in contact with those members of their community. The empirical evidence shows that prison education, you know, breaks the intergenerational cycle of incarceration and, you know, poverty by virtue of, you know, these people having role models. Also, I mean, it's incredibly cost effective. Studies have shown that for every $1 we invest in prison education, we reduce future incarceration costs by $4 to $5 during the first 3 years post-release. It dramatically reduces recidivism rates. And so when we're talking about, you know, inner city violence and the national recidivism rate is actually quite high. You know, one of the surveys showed that, you know, they studied, you know, over 400,000 prisoners in 30 states. And within 5 years of release, about 76% of released prisoners were rearrested. The recidivism rates for those who engage in prison education is dramatically lower. It goes down to 5.6% for people who obtain bachelor's degrees.
Yeah, Jennifer, which is one of the reasons people talk a lot about in the last election, they talked a lot about the 1994 crime bill. Here's one of the things I did not realize about the 1994 crime bill until I started digging in for this show. It eliminated eligibility of prisoners for Pell Grants, and that wiped out all of these education in prison programs that were run and funded by the states and all that sort of stuff. And now it's all volunteer labor. The reason we need people like you is because Bill Clinton, in his wisdom, compromising with the Republicans, eliminated Pell Grant eligibility for prisoners. That was such a short-sighted thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, there are these second chance Pell Grants going on now, but it's, you know, it's a very, very small percentage. But you're exactly right. I mean, I have students at Stateville who also say that they will actually try, their families will try to pay for correspondence courses for them. They will pay for it on their own, and the prisons won't allow it because they won't proctor the exams, or they won't, you know, kind of. So, I mean, there literally is no way for them to obtain an education, despite the fact that everything shows that it is one of the, probably the most effective means for, you know, cutting recidivism.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about prison philosophy behind bars with Jennifer Lackey from Northwestern University. We'd love to have your comments or questions. Curtis from Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Curtis. What's your comment or question?
Oh, well, it's just basically a comment. I just want to kind of reinforce what Dr. Lackey just mentioned, the impact of education on reducing recidivism. Myself being formerly incarcerated and benefactor of a program called Prison University Project at San Quentin really changed the trajectory of my life. I was able to get out and start an undergraduate program at San Francisco State through a program called Project Rebound, which is a program that's been on campus for about 50 years, started by a gentleman named John Irwin. And, you know, we continue to carry his legacy posthumously, but Project Rebound is a program that assists formerly incarcerated men and women to matriculate into the CSU system, and we're currently expanding this program to 8 additional CSU campuses throughout the state.
Well, that's really good information, Curtis. Jennifer, you have any particular thing you want to respond to, Curtis?
Just thanks for calling in. That's really wonderful to hear.
We've also got Catherine from Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Catherine.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I just want to mention that prior to the downturn in the economy in 2010, there was a robust higher education through adult education. Lots of adult ed teachers were employed in the prison system, and I wonder what's going on with that now. And another comment, I understand that people can donate books to the prisons, as well as send new books from Amazon directly to inmates. And what kind of information do you have on that?
Thanks for the call, Catherine. Jennifer, you got any response to that? Do you know?
So, yes, there are many programs where you can send books directly, either like our law school at Northwestern just donated a significant number of books to the law library at Stateville. That was done. You have to do that at a prison by prison basis. And there are also ones, like you said, where you can send, you know, books directly to particular prisoners. So I would contact, you know, a prison nearby you to find out more details.
So, Jennifer, there's a kind of a stereotype of people who work in the prison system as hard A's, right, who want to, you know, grind down inmates and all that sort of stuff. I wonder, from your experience, is that true? Do people who work inside the prison system think, why can't Americans see the humanity of these people? Why can't we have more resources for education? Or are they just, let's herd these people and grind them down? I mean, what is it from your experience?
You know, I've seen both, Ken. I mean, I've seen some people who are very resentful that a Northwestern professor is coming in and teaching incarcerated, you know, men at Stateville when perhaps their own children could not afford, you know, a college degree for their own children or even for themselves. And then I've seen other people who have, you know, really recognized the potential and, you know, of the students and the way that it impacts the overall environment. I mean, you have guys standing around at Stateville now talking about, you know, the morality of, you know, the death penalty or cultural relativism or, you know, issues rather than talking about, you know, I mean, just gambling or, you know, other things that they might otherwise do. So I think they see the impact that it has on the overall community there.
So Jennifer, just a little bit of a change of direction here. When I think about being inspired by you and teaching in prison, of course, then I think, well, what would I teach? Oh, well, I suppose, you know, Frege, a little logic, maybe proper names. Then I have a feeling, no, that might not go over so well. So what kind of things do you teach? And is my skepticism that I could get students in prison interested in kind of this abstract philosophy of language, is that correct, or is that a misunderstanding?
No, I think that, I mean, you know, I'm in you know, conversation with other people at Northwestern on getting a full-blown prison education program off the ground at Stateville. And I think that, you know, one of the things that it's important to do is to approach prison education as that education. And, you know, you can teach the same exact classes that you would teach at Stanford in a prison. And that's the way that I try to approach it. Sure, there are some topics that have particular poignance. I mean, when I was teaching, you know, the morality of the death penalty, you know, I've taught that for 16 years in my undergraduate classes. When you have two students who were on death row, that offers a very unique perspective.
I would think and so.
Yeah. And so, you know, sure, some issues speak to them, perhaps more than others. I mean, but I think that in general, prison education, you know, it really ought to be the case where you could teach, you know, linguistics, anthropology, sociology, any class that you would otherwise teach at your home institution should be able to be taught
there. I want to ask you a kind of a personal question. I mean, who do you think has changed more by prison education? I mean, have you changed more? Have your students changed more? I mean, I would imagine this has changed you too.
Absolutely. I mean, what I tell my students is that they, more than anyone else, they've reminded me what I love about education. They've reminded me about the absolute transformative power of an education. I mean, when I see, I mean, sure, I mean, my Northwestern students show that to me, but it typically it's over a very long stretch of time. And where they started and where they ended up, you know, it's a kind of a smaller progression because they start off, you know, in a different place and they end up in a different place than many of my incarcerated students do. But you know, when you have students, I have a man in my class right now who has been incarcerated for decades. I don't even know how long. And when he was giving me his introduction, you know, he said, "I've been incarcerated forever. I have not been in a classroom for decades, you know, and one day I woke up and said, I just want something more." And I've seen him grow week by week by week. And you really see what education can do. I mean, literally on a weekly basis. And it has made me love my job more than I loved it before I started teaching in the prisons. I think it's absolutely transformed me.
Well, Jennifer, that's really powerful. You know, not much in philosophy moves me to tears, but something I read of yours actually moved me to tears, because this is really a powerful stuff. And I'm glad you're here to share it with us. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking about teaching and studying philosophy in prison with Jennifer Lackey from Northwestern University.
In our final segment, we'll ask whether we can ever muster the political will to change our system of incarceration. And if so, how?
The will to change, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Could we fund a really good rock and roll program in prison? Probably not. But surely a little philosophy in prison would be a good thing. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Jennifer Lackey from Northwestern University. We're thinking about philosophy behind bars. And we've got a caller, Anthony, from San Francisco on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anthony.
Good morning. Really interesting program. And I'm wondering, in addition to the benefits for the students and for the people who are teaching them, I loved hearing about the students going into the prison in Kansas. What does it do to the rest of us to start thinking about people in prison as people who can study and benefit from philosophy, for instance?
Good question, Anthony. What do you think, Jennifer?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And I mean, I think that we have seen a radical shift in the social attitudes towards incarceration in general over the last, you know, decade or so. And I think that much of that is by, you know, people humanizing the incarcerated much more so than we ever have before. And so the more prison education programs that we have and the more that we see people, you know, kind of walking up and getting degrees and seeing what they're capable of, I think the more that, you know, we as a society will change as well and start breaking down the barrier between the inside and the outside. I mean, I think that we tend to think that people who are incarcerated are not members of our community. We've tucked them away where we can't see them. And we no longer have to, you know, kind of think about them or worry about them. And I think that, you know, thinking about, you know, the incarcerated in such a positive way as, you know, getting degrees, for instance, will transform our perceptions of them as well.
So Jennifer, we want to get into what we can do to improve prisons, but I have one more question I want to ask. You sound very upbeat, but lots of philosophers are more like me, just kind of on the edge of depression. And when they philosophize, words like nothing come to the top. And what's it all about? Who knows? Who cares? Is that kind of philosophical perspective? Is that one you should kind of, if you're teaching in prison, you should really be careful not to share with the inmates?
You mean like a negative perspective? Is that
like
what you're
nihilism,
saying?
Nietzsche, yeah. Camus?
I see.
You must imagine Camus happy, you know, right?
It's really interesting because just on Wednesday, the topic for the day was the meaning of life, and we were talking. We were, you know, reading, variants on the myth of Sisyphus, and we were talking about it with the students, and they came in and they said this resonated with me so much. They said decades of filing appeals and having hearings, and they said it feels like, you know, pushing the boulder up the rock only to have it come back down. And it was incredibly, I mean, you know, there was a moment in the class where I did worry, like, gosh, I mean, I didn't assign this reading for you to think of your existence that way, because obviously there's a sense in which, you know, the daily toil of prison life can feel very much like pushing a rock up only to have it come back down. But one of the things that's so striking about education is precisely that it's able to defeat that helplessness that you feel.
I mean, it's the human, look, and these prisoners, these inmates, they live this futility. And the triumph of the human spirit is not to deny that threat of futility, but to face that threat of futility and find a way to go on in the face of that. And I think you'd be discredited if you came in all sunny-eyed and optimistic rather than,
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, I mean, they certainly are not sunny-eyed. You know what I mean? Like, they certainly have their eyes wide open. And so, you know, obviously we talk about a lot of things that are, I mean, I taught a whole class on mass incarceration. That was not an easy class. But I think that one of the things that's most powerful is having their eyes wide open and being educated. I mean, I had one student look me squarely in the face, and he said, he was pointing to the reading on his desk, and he said, "This is like gold. This is like gold." He said, "To be able to learn how I got here, how I ended up here, you know, all the forces at work that put me in this seat right
so
here."
So let me ask you a question, okay, from the voice of the skeptical. Possibly, right? And this investment of social resources and all this. Yes, sounds like your students are exceptional. One could think your students are exceptional among the prison population. There's a select population for whom this kind of thing will reach them. And we want to reach the exceptional. But in general, I mean, is that true of the generalized population? And would we be deceiving ourselves if we thought, we should offer this up to all? Maybe there's just a few exceptional. Like, you know, some people, there used to be prison release programs. So I think those have gone down. But those were for the exceptional inmate.
Right. I mean, you know, certainly do I think that every single person incarcerated at Stateville would want to be in one of these classes? No. But I know that there are many, many people. When I have to go to my classroom, I have to walk the full length of the yard. So, you know, guys will be out there, you know, like running or, you know, kind of working out. And I can't tell you how many weeks I walk by where they come running and saying, "Are you that Northwestern professor? Can I get in your next class?" I mean, there's such a strong need and desire for this and I don't think that Stateville is anomalous. I mean, I've talked to many other people at prison education programs, and this is very standard. And so the need is far greater at this point than what we are able to offer, far greater.
So that brings up this two-sided thing of this talk with you. It's very inspiring and wonderful, but for it raises up this enormous abyss of people who could benefit but aren't benefiting. Is there anything we can do, any practical way we can humanize and make education accessible to more inmates?
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, you know, on the positive side, I know of at least four or five, very high-end prison education programs that have been launched in the United States just in the last 5 years. And so people are, coming around to seeing that these are incredibly valuable for all involved. I mean, the incarcerated, the professors, I think the university, I think Northwestern benefits from this. I think, you know, Illinois benefits from this. And so I think that we're seeing more and more of these programs come around. And I think that the more we talk about this, the more more we educate the public on the benefits of prison education, I think the more we'll be able to see, an increased number of incarcerated students getting, even degrees. I think one of the things that people are moving away from is relying on taxpayer dollars, and we're looking more and more for universities funding these, right. Particularly wealthy, privileged universities funding these.
Robert from Richardson Bay is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Robert.
Wow, what a wonderful program. I'm a great guest. Listen, Sam Quinton is now suddenly, instead of being the hardest of the hard, has the longest waiting list to get into, because I think there's a documentary about the great programs they have there. But here's my question is, you said it was all volunteer. Does it have to be all volunteer university credentialed PhDs that get into these programs? I personally have a hard time even getting to be a substitute teacher in a public school without some sort of ABC after my name, but believe me, I would be one of these good instructors on political reality, for one thing. But is that true? Is it volunteer? Are you not being paid to go from Northwestern to the prison?
Well, by volunteer, no one in the state is paying me, but Northwestern supports my teaching. Now,
question before we waste too much time is, I've been busted a lot of times, and I've been able to get good lawyers and get off because the cops lied and this and that. Jerry Spence claims all cops lied in every case he ever had. So there's a prison called Pelican Bay, and it's the new Supermax, and it's way out of the way. And there's no place for any volunteers to live there. I mean, and that's the trend, is to build them. I mean, I worked on a prison. I built a prison in Utah that's a county jail that holds 1,200 inmates. So there's 1,200 feet on its side and costs hundreds of millions of dollars to build. And they built it to rent space to California.
Mm-hmm. Good questions. Mm-hmm. Let's hear some answers.
Yeah, so I mean, it depends on the program, is the way I'd say it. I mean, the program that I'm going to be, hoping to start with Northwestern and Stateville, you need to be a university professor, because we're hoping to ultimately be issuing degrees. And I think in many of these prison education programs, they don't like to regard the professors or the faculty members as volunteers exactly, even though they're not getting state money. Because particularly, I think my students have asked me this before: do you regard this as charity? Do you have, are you doing this out of charity? And I said, no. I'm doing this because I believe in the value of education and the power of education.
But our society, as a collectivity, has not collectively decided that we are going to invest in this as a political thing. I mean, I think it would be great if the people, as a democratic deliberative body, said, the inmates are still members of our polity. We still owe them certain things. We still owe them chances. You wrote this interesting thing about how, life without the possibility of parole, that's a stupid thing, because it doesn't even let you consider the question, has this person changed? I mean, that's just so stupid. Right. How could we be so stupid?
Right. Yes, I believe. I mean, obviously, ideally, we would start investing, state resources into this as well. I mean, in my own class at Stateville, I invited our state senators to come visit my class. I invited our congresswoman. They all accepted my invitations, and they all came and spoke one-on-one with my students. I have 15 men in my class, and they sat and spoke with them. I did this partly because I want us to start having this conversation at that level as well.
Right. So how do we get that? Do you think we can do that? Do you think is there any political possibility that we as a collective will say, yes, we ought to do this kind of thing?
Well, I had a little bit more optimism before the recent election. I mean, I think
why am I laughing?
My answer is going to be different now. I mean, I think that we were on a particular trajectory where I was optimistic about prison education, for instance, and about having education programs in prisons and using them towards time served and trying to, kind of do away with, as many natural life sentences. It's hard for me to say with the recent election. I mean, right now, what I would suggest we do is start, kind of increasing the prison education programs through private institutions, or, like we're doing now, getting your Northwesterns to try to put some money towards these.
Well, Jennifer, I think we've just scratched the surface. This has been a really wonderful conversation. I really applaud the work you're doing, and I thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest has been Jennifer Lackey. She's a professor of philosophy at Northwestern University. She also teaches at philosophy at Stateville Correctional Center near Chicago. So, John, what are your thoughts about this now?
It's just great to hear Jennifer tell us about this, and it's very inspiring. But also, you came up with a great idea for a philosophy talk show. How can we be so stupid? We should think about that. Somehow it seems very timely.
Yeah, I know. Collective rationality, the rationality of institutions and social practices is a thing that's underexplored. Because, you know, here's a problem. People making their individual decisions, having their individual values, and then politicians manipulating our decision-making leads to these what seem to be satisfying, must be satisfying, because we keep electing people who get us to do these things, but they're collectively stupid. I mean, our prison system is not just immoral, it's stupid.
How do you really feel?
That it's stupid, right? That the way we've set this up, this revolving door prison system, is really, really stupid. But you know what? This conversation, which is intelligent, continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website and clicking a few buttons here and there, philosophytalk.org.
Now, if this guy studied philosophy in prison, he'd speed read his way to early release. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, over the years, we've had many literary works that first found their form in prison, including Oscar Wilde's Reading Jail and Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius brought him consolation, I believe, when he was in prison. O. Henry wrote his early short stories when he's in prison for embezzlement. It was said, though denied by an official at Angola, that Leadbelly's songs were a factor in his pardoning in 1925. He would often perform in stripy convict garb, and there's your damn authentic right there. There's also the book In the Belly of the Beast by Jack Henry Abbott, whose writing so impressed writer Norman Mailer, he lobbied for his release from prison, and a month and a half later, he killed somebody. There are many artists whose time spent in prison became part of what made them famous. Robert Lowell, 50 Cent, Malcolm X, maybe not so much with Tim Allen or Robert Downey Jr., but there's the Marquis de Sade, who created his most famous works while imprisoned, which inspired the play Marat Sade in the 20th century. Other prison plays include Short Eyes, Fortune and Men's Eyes, and Stalag 17, later also a movie. There are many great prison novels, including Our Lady of the Flowers by Jean Genet. Many prison books are political in nature, or poetic, or polemical, like Soul on Ice. There's a long history of melodramatic prison stories, which usually include daring escapes and sword fights. This would include The Prisoner of Zenda, The Count of Monte Cristo, The Man in the Iron Mask. Does escape from an island count? Sure it does. Along with Alcatraz and Sing Sing, Devil's Island was the go-to source for many prison stories, including We're No Angels and Papillon, not to mention Devil's Island with Boris Karloff. Other island prisons, Most Dangerous Game, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and even Jurassic Park. There's a movie set in a future island prison starring Ray Liotta called No Escape. Future prisons offer all kinds of dystopian alternatives. There are Escape from New York, Judge Dredd, THX 1138, various underground or outer space penitentiary equivalents, movies where the prison is a train, like Snowpiercer, Runaway Train, movies in which prisoners learn from their experience, Birdman of Alcatraz, Dead Man Walking, Green Mile, Shawshank Redemption, American History X, prisoners forced to participate in games by evil officials, like Longest Yard, Escape to Victory, remember that one with Pele? I suppose Bridge on the River Kwai might qualify there as well. And there are the always popular Great Escape movies, like The Great Escape, Grand Illusion, Rescue Dawn, Down by Law, on and on. Movies about great escape artists like Cool Hand Luke, The Fugitive, and the classic series The Prisoner. Movies about prisoners released to do a hopeless job like Dirty Dozen, or escape movies where everything goes horribly wrong like the Burt Lancaster movie Brute Force, or Con Air, or maybe even Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Now we binge-watch prison stories like Orange is the New Black, Oz, or even episodes of Breaking Bad, or Westworld, a prison story if you think about it. We've come a long way from I Was a Prisoner in a Chain Gang and Breakout. Remember that one? Charles Bronson busts Robert Duvall out of prison with a helicopter. Maybe it'll show up on Netflix, which we watch from the prison of our couch, metaphorically. So, to sum up, in prison pictures, we got riots and breakouts and wrongful imprisonment and corrupt politics and kickboxing convicts and hard-hitting exposés and tunnels. We used to enjoy women in prison movies. Women in prison movies used to be a staple of drive-ins, but they are gone, alas, probably forever. Drive-ins, not women. Oh, well, we'll always have Netflix until it's gone. And couches, of course, will always be with us, unless we're in Sing Sing. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I haven't had a vacation in years. This is my vacation. I'm exercising. I'm sleeping well.
You're doing time.
I'm doing the time of my life.